And we are back. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, for my favorite segment of the show, interview time. Been wanting to have this guy on for a bit now, especially since his most recent appearance on Real Vision. And it's been a while since we had him on. So welcome again to the show, Mr. Kevin Muir.
It's great to be with you today, Zach.
Hey, before we get started, I want to start with, we talked about the Macro Tourist letter last time, and I told you I was subscribing, and I realized this morning when I was going to have you on, I'd completely spaced out and didn't do it, but I am looking right now at a page on the Macro Tourist website that says, thank you, you are subscribed as Zach at Bulwark Capital Management. So I have officially done what I told you I was going to do.
Oh, it's very kind of you. I appreciate the support, Zach.
Well, and you don't need it. I was just saying that I'd missed. I was sitting there the other day, and I think I saw you post, or no, it was this morning. I don't know where, but I saw a recent post, and I went, "Oh crap, I miss reading it." I also have been meaning, you know. Anyway, so we all
let's be truthful, Zach. You missed the pictures. Everyone says they're subscribing for the letter, but we know they're just going for the pictures.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I wouldn't. I mean, you know, that's how I still buy books. You know what I mean? there aren't enough pictures in it. That's why technical analysis is luring me more and more by the day. No words needed, right?
I hear you.
Anyway, man, it was really interesting to hear your take on Real Vision recently because I have been concerned about things economically and still am concerned, yet at the same time, I kind of see this explosive atmosphere, if you will, and it feels like somebody's about ready to strike a match, and I believe in your interview, you referred to it as a room full of gasoline and somebody was going to smoke a cigarette or something like that.
Right.
Anyway, can you walk us through that a little bit and get into that a little bit for our listeners
sure.
that haven't seen that interview?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. So over the last 40 years, we've tried to solve every single slowdown through monetary means, meaning that we've lowered interest rates whenever we've had a recession. And what this has done is it's put all the focus on the private sector taking more and more debt. And that's basically how, you know, you encourage new consumption when the economy slows down by lowering rates. So someone goes out and they buy a house or they buy a new car, and that's how you get it going. The trouble is that we've done this for the past 40 years, as I mentioned. And in 2008, when the great financial crisis hit, we hit the point at zero. You know, we lowered rates to zero and people still didn't want to take any money. And the reason for that is that basically the balance sheets were stretched and people were feeling rightfully very scared about it. And we then proceeded to go do a whole raft of new kind of monetary, you know, science projects where, you know, quantitative easing, Operation Twist, all these different things. And at the same time, you know, the problem at that time was that we had too much debt in the system. And it was mostly private and corporate debt that I'm talking about at that time. And the government looked at it and said, geez, if they have too much debt, we have too much debt. That's a real problem. And the government went and actually cut spending in the great financial crisis. And a lot of people think about it. Oh, no. Like, you know, Obama was one of the most spendthrift presidents around. And I always say, if you look through history and you look through what, you know, the federal budget, the discretionary budget, meaning the amount that they get to spend, you know, and what the programs they're choosing. And this is kind of on the side, you know, you have the things that you don't have a choice about, which is like food, Medicare and food stamps and all those, you know, unemployment insurance. All those are kind of mandatory spending that the government can't control. But if you look at the discretionary side, the part that they actually can decide how much they spend, and if you look over the past 40 years, there was only 3 years when the government actually cut. It was 64, 68. It was, you know, Kennedy, Johnson, I think it was the war. You know, they were worried about spending too much back then. And then it was 96 with Clinton. So every other year, we actually had more and more government spending. Well, 1998 comes around, and what happens? We have 4 years in a row where the government cuts the budget, I mean, cuts their discretionary spending. Okay. So think about this. The private sector is contracting and the credit is being destroyed because we have basically a crisis of confidence because we've taken out too much debt. And then the government goes and does the exact same thing. And what this did was it made it so that Bernanke and the other central banks had to do these crazy, crazy, you know, monetary stimulus programs. And then it didn't work. And they tried to stimulate the economy, but, you know, for a whole host of reasons we can talk about, but that just didn't work. Now, let's contrast that to today. COVID comes along, and what does the government do? The government doesn't go and stop spending. In fact, the government goes and spends tons. And they also, at the same time, do all the monetary stimulus that they did in the previous time. And if you think back to, you know, the March COVID crisis, when everyone was very scared about the economy, very scared that the markets were going to collapse. I was telling people, I said, listen, the government can fill a lot of this hole. People do not understand that the reason it was so bad before was because the government wasn't doing this, wasn't doing the fiscal. And this time when they did it, the big surprise has been how much, you know, both the markets and the economy have done well subsequent to the COVID crisis. Like, you know, we look at this and things are terrible. The economy is still awful. And I just want to take a moment out here to say I'm by no means trying to diminish the personal and the toll this has had on a lot of people. And I completely understand. And one of the problems is that we're throwing money out there and it's and often not getting to the right people. So I don't want to try to make this sound like things are great because they're not. But, you know, I work in the markets for a living and I have to just kind of guess where the market's going to go. So it doesn't do me any good to sit around and talk about the terribleness of kind of on the personal basis because it's not my job. My job is the markets. And from the markets perspective, they've pushed all of this kind of fiscal and monetary stimulus in at the same time. And not only that, they haven't shown any signs of letting up, Zach. It's just they keep going and going and going. And now finally we have the vaccine. The market is looking through and saying, yeah, this is going to be an absolutely brutal winter. It's going to be terrible from a human point of view. But we can see that come summer, our lives are going to get back to normal. And when I think about, you know, myself, my family, my friends, I don't know about you, Zach, but everyone I know is just itching to go do all the things that we haven't done. And I think about what's going to happen in the summer and I realize we're going to have the government spending more than we've ever had. We're going to have interest rates and quantitative easing, the likes of which we've never seen before. And then all of a sudden, we're going to have this kind of moment where people are able to once again go and live their lives. And I look at it and I say, this is going to be just a boom, the likes that we've never seen before. Like we're approaching the 2020s, and I say that I think the last time that we've had this kind of scenario was in the 1920s when we came out of the Spanish flu and the World War I, and then it proceeded to have that kind of decade of just opulence and craziness. And I could very much see that that's what's going to happen here. But the one real key about all this is that this was because the government changed their tune in terms of on the fiscal side. So the thing to watch for is to make sure that that continues. And if we do get a situation where the deficit, you know, the deficit hawks come back, then that's another story.
Yeah, what I was saying is it's, you know, again, whether you agree with it or not, history's the rhythm and rhyme and pattern to history is pretty clear. If you've got conservatives, or, you know, especially if you got a majority of conservatives in the Senate, it's amazing how quick they find fiscal religion with Democrats in the White House, right?
You know, you're absolutely right.
Right. I mean, these guys haven't even Velcroed their wallets shut in, you know, the last 10 years. Yeah, they did under Obama as well. But, I mean, you know, did you even hear the word debt or deficit over the past 4 years? I don't think I even heard it except on, you know, Twitter or something like that.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right.
So that is a constant threat. And I was laughing earlier when you were talking about how governments increased spending every year. One of the things that I love is the vernacular that bureaucrats put around spending to avoid calling it anything but spending, right? And taxes are called revenue. The term that describes those automatic spending increases every single year are those automatic stabilizers, right?
Right.
It's good. That's what we're going to call it. And I just always found that so humorous. It's not extra spending that we've baked into the cake, right? It's an automatic stabilizer.
Right.
So anyway, I think we're going to see a lot more stabilization, if you will. Okay, so the other thing that you talked about, and I think it's really important to point out, I was listening to a – I'm kind of going all over the place at this point, but I was listening to a podcast with Joe Rogan, and they were talking about the devastation that the lockdowns have had on business, and they were saying that they couldn't believe that the government hasn't even helped these people. And I kind of sat back and was a bit shocked by that and engaged a lot of my clients in conversations, and it amazes me, Kevin, that a lot of people out there, especially people that – see it as so bleak. Now, I am not saying it's not. I think the devastation of small businesses is real, and it personally, it's disgusting to me. Somehow a lot of these people do not understand that, like, the average consumer's income rose through this, and that the right. savings rate went substantially higher because of that extra 2,400 a month they were tacking on to regular unemployment insurance.
Yeah. Which was, in a lot of cases, I think, above what they were making before.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Which is why it's the first recession in the history of the United States, with both rising corporate debt levels and rising consumer incomes, right? So, I mean, there, as far as the consumer's balance sheet goes, there, you know, for the most part, isn't a lot of damage. And I think you're right, man. I feel like you got the horses, right, all lined up in the gates, just waiting for the bell to sound, and you those lockdowns come off, and I mean I think it's going to look like Panama Beach pretty much all over the country, you know.
I like that. That's a great
you know
line.
What I mean? I, yeah. You just talk to people, and they're like, "When this is over," I was joking back and forth with a Twitter friend earlier today. And they were saying, yeah, when this is over, I'm going to be standing on a bar. And, you know, like, you're
right.
You know, you're like, yeah, there's a lot of pent up experiences that.
Yeah. You know, that, we're all going to be coyote uglies. The other thing to think about, Zach, when you're kind of putting together this picture and this narrative, is that what's killed bull markets in the past has traditionally been a Federal Reserve that has been willing to raise rates because they've been worried about inflation. And what has also changed is not only have we had an attitude change in terms of the fiscal that governments are going to do, we've also had a complete change in attitude at the Federal Reserve level, in that this introduction of average inflation targeting, where they look over a longer period. So that means if there's, you know, 2 years of 1% inflation, that means theoretically they could have 2 years of 3% inflation to average out at 2%. If you look at this shift in attitude, it also means that once we do get going and the economy picks up, they're not going to be as quick to, you know, step on the brake as they have in the past, which is just another reason that I think that we're going to be shocked at the amount of growth that occurs in the second half of 2021 and 22.
Okay, so you think that you're seeing it roll all the way out through 2022, and this is one of the things that I want to dig into with you. Was one of the things I'm looking at is the massive amount of damage that has been been brought by this economically. Small business still being the biggest employer in the United States, the unavoidable problems coming down the pipe in commercial real estate, what seems to me like is going to be structurally higher unemployment due to the shale situation. Do those chickens come home to roost, or do you think that just a? Do you think that when I speak of those things and their demise, that I'm being too presumptive, or is it not going to be as bad in those areas as I'm saying or thinking it could be? Or do you just think it doesn't matter, that you just paper right over the top of it and off we go?
Well, I don't think papering is the right word. And if it was just papering, then I would be more concerned about it. If we were trying to solve this problem like we did in 2008, meaning we just do more and more quantitative easing, then I wouldn't be nearly as bullish as I am. I would be concerned about the basically inequality doing better, stocks going better, but the real economy not doing any better at all. And that's basically what we saw in 2008. Sure, stocks started rising and, you know, financial, the rich kept getting richer, but the average, you know, person on Main Street, that didn't help them. And that was back to the point that the government was, you know, not expanding the money supply. And everyone thinks that they go and quantitative easing is this, you know, inflationary, you know, that kind of force that's going to, you know, unleash all this hyperinflation on us. But if we kind of stop and think about the mechanics of quantitative easing, the government goes, the Federal Reserve goes and buys, you know, a bond from J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan sells them that bond. The J.P. Morgan gets credited with the cash, or in this case, what they call bank reserves. And the traditional view, the economist view, was that the J.P. Morgan went and lent all those out. And that caused the inflation. And that was what was so scary about quantitative easing, was that there's going to be all these reserves in the system. And when they got lent out, that they were going to, you know, cause this hyperinflationary, you know, disaster. Well, just stop and think about, if you're JP Morgan, you know, you're Jamie Dimon running JP Morgan, are you any more likely to write a loan just because the Fed's bought some, you know, bonds from you? The reality is that you were always constrained by your balance sheet. You were constrained by how much equity and how much, you know, bonds and capital you had on your balance sheet. And then you were also constrained by how much, you know, proper willing customers that you had, with the demand side of it.
Or the credit quality of those, that demand too.
Right, you know, and that's your choice. But so people think that quantitative easing is inflationary, and it's anything but. And so one of the worries that I have is that when everyone sits around and says, oh, you know, Federal Reserve is doing all this, it's going to cause all this inflation, I say it's not going to cause that inflation. We've proved that it hasn't, because we had no inflation, even though they did more quantitative easing at any time, you know, in 2008, 9, and 10. Yeah, we couldn't get inflation for the everything we tried. And so going back to your question about the small business and stuff, the real kind of decision that governments have to make is, are they going to try to fix this with more quantitative easing, or are we going to see actual fiscal programs where the government starts spending? And so far, there's been lots of, you know, let's just say noise around the idea that once we come out of this, you know, recession, this self-imposed slowdown, the governments are going to, you know, spend a lot of money doing infrastructure programs. You just look at Europe. Europe just agreed on another $2 trillion of infrastructure spending that's actually, you know, shared amongst all the all the countries, which was quite unusual. Here in Canada, we're putting into place all sorts of programs that once we come out of it, the, you know, big projects and things of that nature. And so when you ask me about the small business person, there's no doubt that there's going to be a lot of pain in terms of individual businesses closing and all that. But if money goes out through actual, you know, building stuff and spending it and boots on the ground kind of things, then I actually believe that we're going to be, the economy is going to surprise how strong it is. And we're going to be shocked, just like we were shocked that the economy didn't fall apart when COVID came and the government did all this. We're going to be shocked at the fact that even though there's all these problems and there's all these transitions as companies go bankrupt and things, there's going to be new companies springing up. There's going to be new opportunities because the government's going to be spending. Now, at this point, a lot of people are hearing, like, going, oh, geez, this guy lives in like a pie in the sky fantasy land. And he just thinks that government spending is going to fix all the problems. And I do think that the government spending is going to fix the immediate problems. And I do believe that we're going to be surprised at how strong the economy is, because if you think about it, over the last 40 years, like I mentioned, we've never tried to fix slowdowns with fiscal stimulus. We've always just tried to fix it with monetary stimulus. So we've never gone and tried to, you know, drive the car from the fiscal side. But like monetarism was abused, and there's no doubt it was abused, because all you have to do is look at Europe and see, you know, negative rates or 0% rates in the States to realize that, you know, we always take things too far. I suspect that this fiscal spending will also be taken too far. And the key to it, to understanding that, is that I think we're going to get inflation way quicker than we expect, and it's going to be way more violent than we expect. All you have to do is look at lumber. I think lumber is going to be the kind of poster child of what's going to happen as the government pushes money into the system. And the thing that all these people feared in 08 with, you know, quantitative easing causing hyperinflation, or at least very strong inflation, I think it's ironic that all those, you know, pundits that were signing open letters on the Wall Street Journal to Bernanke now believe that there's no way that quantitative easing is going to cause inflation. And although I agree quantitative easing won't cause inflation, I do believe that fiscal spending, of which the size that we're planning on doing, very much could cause inflation. So I look at lumber that went from 220 to almost $1,000 in like 6 months, because there was all this demand for people building houses, and not only that, here in Canada we couldn't cut them down enough because our workers were being, they had to isolate and things like that. So we had a supply constraint at the same time we had huge demand. Well, I look and I think that's going to happen all across the board. So I think you're going to look back and you're going to be like, holy smokes, look at it might be copper, it might be grains. I don't know what it is, but I think you'll find that those explosive movements, and it'll be commodities doubling, tripling, even quadrupling in very short order, is going to happen.
Yeah, that I definitely see that. But the path that I think they're going to take, and the path that seems most obvious to me, I mean, I can't disagree with you. And for the people out there saying it is just pie in the sky, I think you'd be well to remember, or you'd be wise to remember, that, you know, you're coming off the biggest bull market in the history of this country. And it was all done on the back of the weakest growing, in real terms, the weakest decade of economic growth in history, right? So all we're doing in my, now again, we're going from monetary to fiscal, and I get that. But really, that's just kind of a steroid-type version of what we've been doing the last 10 years, except it's even more potent. You know, I think it's exponentially greater. It's not, you know, multiples. You know what I mean? I think...
Oh, I 100% agree.
And if
the other thing...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, I've been saying, if you don't think that that is possible, and that you can't, you know, that regardless of the economic conditions, that the government spending can't make up for it... you know, people are like, well, they can't keep kicking the can down the road. Well, that's been the game plan for over a decade now, right? And they're just going to kick harder, and a harder kick, a bigger kick, right? A kick to hit a 55-yarder, there's your monetary stimulus. I mean, excuse me, yeah, the fiscal stimulus. I mean, that's what it is, right? That's the steroids, if you will. And, you know, like I said, I mean, you're looking at the biggest contraction in GDP in a single year we've had since the Great Depression, and every index is up double digits, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, if that doesn't tell you that they can override traditional economic forces by passing dough out, you know, I don't know what'll convince you.
Well, and I think that we haven't really understood economics as well as we believed we had. We were sitting there, we were stuck in thinking there's two ways that a government, you know, a society or a financial economy can make money, can create money. One is through the private sector, through, you know, fractional reserve lending at the bank. So you go buy a house and the bank makes up those dollars that it lends you, and that actually puts it into the system. But the other way is that the government can spend it into existence. And you might hate MMT, you might think it's terrible, and you might get, you know, throw up a little in your mouth all the time when you hear it. But the truth of the matter is that it's coming, and you can complain about it all you want, but you'll be sitting there with your treasury bond that you own at 1% because you think deflation is occurring, and then meanwhile we're going to have, I think, 3, 4, even 5% inflation, and those treasury bonds are going to be a terrible investment.
All of this hinges, though, on them actually writing the checks. And I agree with you, they're going to. That's happening. That's going to be baked into the cake. The issue, though, like we talked about, in the beginning of this conversation, is the deficit hawks. Right now, they're bickering. We went from 5 weeks ago, we were, you know, bickering or going back and forth regarding $1.8 trillion in stimulus. Now, they're balking at $900 billion. This is all predicated on the fact that they actually sign the checks, right?
No doubt. And but the one thing to think about is that America's not the only country in the world, and there's other countries that are going to all be doing it. And you're going to find that the economies that do best are the ones that are willing to spend. Like, one of my big kind of investment themes right now is to own Japan. You go look at Japan. Japan's doing 20%, you know, deficit spending, even though they don't even have a, you know, a corona, you know, issue there. And you might think, oh God, that's terrible. And I, you know, I just think you look at the past 10 years and you wonder what was the strongest stock market and the strongest economy. It was actually the United States. And the reason, you know, there's, you are a very industrious nation with tons of smart people, and there's lots of great things about it. But at the same time, part of the reason that you guys, you know, outperformed the rest of the world was everybody else was trying to balance their budget. And you guys were going, you know, especially once Trump came, you were cutting taxes and you were doing fiscal stimulus. And what's happened now is that the rest of the world has figured this out. And they're not only that, they're going one step further. They're doing it even though they don't have the corona issue. And so I look at Japan and I say, they've been stuck in this, you know, just 20 years since they went and their bubble burst. They basically have been going nowhere. And now all of a sudden they're willing to spend. And everyone says to me, isn't, you know, Japan an example of an MMT society that's gone awry? Like, isn't it an example of MMT failing? And I say, no, Japan is actually the farthest thing from MMT, because every single time the economy got going, they went and raised taxes. They raised the consumption tax because they were so worried about the deficits and the debts that they were getting. So they were always raising at the first sign of the economy getting going. And so I look at them and I say, you know, they've figured out, they're going for it. That's no longer going to be their encumbrance. And I think you're going to be shocked at how quickly they grow. And, you know, again, I'm sure there's a lot of people listening there going, that's going to make inflation. And I go, yeah, for sure it's going to make inflation. I completely agree. But that's what's happening. And that's what meaning, you know, in an inflationary environment like that, do you want to own bonds in Japan at 25 basis points on the 10-year? Or do you want to own their stocks that are dirt cheap? And all of a sudden the people are going to be, you know, being able to earn money in those stocks because those companies are going to have all sorts of activity and stuff going. So I look at this and I say that, yeah, maybe the States comes back and that you guys end up being more deficit hawkish. But I think the rest of the world has definitely embraced the spending. And I think that if you'll find that if you do go down that road of trying to balance your budget, you're going to be left behind and that the rest of the world is going to do better. Just like in the last decade, you guys did way better than everyone else. All of a sudden, you'll see that everyone else does better.
Well, yeah, to be, and this is one of the things, and I know listening to you that you'll agree with me. One of the things that I have learned in my career, via pain, of course, is the it's never the one thing. You know, everybody's like, well, what is the one thing? What's the one thing that's going to spark inflation? What's the one thing that's going to kick this, you know, recession off? When you look back to it, it always seems to be a culmination of things, right? The same with bubbles. My wife and I were having a conversation about this last night, and she was asking me about something about a bubble, and I was just explaining that, you know, everybody, it looks so obvious in hindsight, but if you look at how bubbles are created, there has to be fertile soil, right? The narrative, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You have to get all these things that come together. And so I don't want to be too simplistic when I say this, but the way I've kind of looked at it is I think Japan is an illustration of the failure of monetary policy.
Yeah, to generate inflation. Agree.
And yeah. I think that Venezuela is more of a picture of, you know, over time and an exaggerated version of MMT. I think Venezuela is a much bigger, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, see, the MMT people will say that once you get inflation, you have to raise taxes. And so the pushback to that is that no politician's going to want it to raise taxes. And then the MMT guys will say, or folks will say, you know what, then that's not MMT. That's just spending. You're no longer practicing MMT. So, I listen, I get all that, the kind of pushback and that argument. the one thing I just kind of stress, Zach, is that in 1981, Volcker came in and he was the Federal Reserve Chairman. He came in and inflation was running hot. Nobody believed that you could ever stop inflation. There was like, you know, there was a famous fellow at Salomon Brothers named Henry Kaufman. I think they called him Dr. Doom. He was the original Dr. Doom. And he just, you know, forecast higher and higher inflation. And Volcker came and he started cranking rates. And nobody believed. Everyone thought, not a chance, not a chance. And it ended up being that, you know, it took a little while. But then eventually he tamed the back of inflation. And it set off the next 40 years of the bond bull market. And I think that just like in 1981, nobody believed that, you know, bonds could ever go up. I think we're at the COVID, and I think it was specifically the COVID crisis, ushered in basically our 1981 moment. It was the moment that governments realized that they could no longer do it with just monetary policy. And then it became acceptable to use fiscal policy. And once that, you know, once that genie was pulled off, once people started to realize that, I think that the world has changed in a very big way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I would agree with you. I one of the things I was thinking about is, and I think you and I have spoken about this and we've talked about it on the show before, so I don't want to beat a dead horse, but, you know, and I'm fleshing this out a little bit as we speak too, but one of the things that I've spent a lot of time looking at is the misconceptions I had, and you addressed this earlier about monetary policy being the result of, you know, and I get there's still going to be people out there that go, oh, no, it's going to end in doom. I get it. But if you're in a technologically driven economy, which we clearly are, and I think that's true of the rest of the world, not just here in the United States, but, you know, technology and innovation is constantly lowering cost. Monetary policy does nothing to generate new demand, right? So if you don't have new demand and the costs are constantly declining via, you know, via technological advancement, and if interest rates are going down, which means costs are declining, right? That's, you know, demand that is neither growing nor shrinking and shrinking costs, that's deflationary, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt there's a lot of kind of overtones of deflationary forces that have kind of pushed down inflation during this period. I would argue as well that China entering the WTO was hugely deflationary. The Berlin Wall, you know, the fall of the Iron Curtain as well was another, you know, kind of push out there in terms of, let's just call it an increase in supply of labor. So there's been all sorts of stuff like that, and I completely agree. But, you know, from that basis, if you think about it, a lot of those forces are almost through. Like, if you go look at China, a lot of the urbanization, meaning people coming from the rural areas into cities, is being done. They have a huge demographics problem the other way, that basically that they have no more young people, and, you know, the one child policy has made it so they have too many males. So there's a lot to be said for that. Some of those big secular forces that we've thought have been so deflationary, they're ending. Another one that I'll throw out there is that everyone talks about the baby boomers, and they talk about how this is so deflationary. These baby boomers aren't going to be spending anything. Well, kind of go look at your chart book again and look at how many millennials there are. There's actually more millennials than there are baby boomers.
Yeah.
It's just that the baby boomers have all the assets. But if you look at the actual numbers, the millennials there's more of them than baby boomers. And so I look at this last little while, and you've seen housing stocks just been on fire, and everyone's, you know, was surprised at the housing. And I say, I'm not surprised at all. And in fact, housing was one of my big picks. And the reason for that was that even though the rest of the world was experiencing a housing boom coming out of the 2009 crisis, you in America didn't. And the reason was, you know, all these millennials saw their parents get smoked in terms of, you know, housing and, you know, speculating. And they looked at it, and it was just like the Great Depression when your grandparents would never want to buy a house because they saw everyone, you know, lose their livelihood from when they went down. It was very much the same way. But what's happened is that eventually these millennials no longer live in their parents' basement. Eventually they go and they form families, And yeah, they're behind, and there's no doubt about it. But everyone tells me how the millennials are so different. And I said, no, you know what? Human beings are human beings.
Yep.
They're going to go start families. They're going to go build. They're going to go want to live in the suburbs or wherever. Well, not maybe not even live in the suburbs, but they're going to start families, and they're going to need more housing, and it's going to go. And so I just look at this and I say, there's all sorts of demand on that side. And I don't worry about the secular forces as much as everyone else, because at the end of the day, if the government wants to, the government can overcome any secular deflationary force that there is. They just need to be willing. And I always, this is one of my things that I always laugh about, Zach. You know, these guys, they'll come and for a long time, these deflationists were very much in vogue. And you know, you can probably name them. You might have even had some on your show. They come here and they tell you how rates are going to zero. And I might even see minus 300 basis points on the 10-year. And they're drawing trend lines and they're extrapolating all this. And I always say, you know, there's going to reach a point where society realizes that no, deflation doesn't help us, and they will understand how they go about making inflation through fiscal means, which is we're finally there. And I always ask people in history, can you tell me how many countries have collapsed because of deflation?
It's never happened.
Right. And yet when you ask how many countries have collapsed because of inflation,
everyone.
There's quite a few.
So
I think we're going to look back and laugh that we thought we couldn't create inflation.
Oh no, it's and you and I have joked about this before, but inflation is the dog chasing the car, right? The real issue is what happens when he catches it. You know, but it's going to happen eventually, right?
Yeah. On that basis, though, just something to think about. I think when it does come, the problem is it'll feel good for a while.
Yeah, like a party in the beginning. Yep.
Yeah, and it's going to be all the debt that you have is going to be getting inflated away, and there's no doubt. I think that inflation will come, and everything will be great, and it'll seem awesome.
I've said before, inflation's like a high school party, man. Just as long as you leave by midnight, you're going to be good. You know, just don't stay too long, right? It's always
in
the beginning,
right? And a lot of people's portfolios are not set up for this, though.
No,
and one of the things, though, I know you're a big value guy, and you love the value stocks. And one of my themes as well has been, you have to continue to look at, you know, making sure your portfolio is exposed to the right types of stocks, and the wrong types of stocks are these high flying growth stocks. That basically, if you think about a growth stock has all of its earnings out in front, meaning that, like, you know, there's not paying dividends, all of their earnings are discounted into the future. So they are, in fact, the longest duration asset in terms of in the stock world. And because of that, that's why you'll find that as interest rates have gone down, the big kind of Googles, Facebook, and all these big growers, they're the ones that have really done well and have excelled. And if we do get my scenario coming to be where we get inflation and eventually higher rates, those are the exact opposite stocks you want to have. And you were laughing and talking to about your wife, and you were saying, talking about bubbles. You know, as bullish as I am, I will tell you that right now we are in a bubble. And we are in a bubble. All you have to do is look at electric vehicles.
Right.
This is unsustainable. These prices are just bat poop crazy. They make no sense. We are going to look back, and again, we're going to just wonder what the heck we were thinking. And, you know, even though I'm bullish, I would tell you your chances of getting absolutely destroyed trading these things are very, very high.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I just to set the record straight here, Kev, when you said that I'm in love with the value stocks, I would describe it more like Stockholm Syndrome.
You know? That's a good line. I'm going to steal that one, Zach. That's a good line.
And when you're, you know, the old adage, man, when you're crossing the Atlantic and you get more than halfway there, you might as well just get going at that point. You know, I mean, it's just been a long, hard road, man.
Well, it's coming. Our day in the sun's coming, bud. Our day in the sun's coming.
Well, and they've been acting, you know, as somebody that's endured this nuclear winter. They've been acting completely different. I mean, completely different. Was it yesterday? No, again, guys, please save me the tweets here. I realize one day a performance does not a trend make, but this has been going on for a while now. And our value portfolio, man, nothing special, with some good cash on the sidelines, has outperformed the market over the last like 2.5 months by, I want to say, 7% or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it could reverse. I'm just saying, I've been running this for a while now, and I haven't seen that happen in quite a long time. And then one of the things that you talked about, the millennials, I completely agree with you. The other thing is that I think the correction in a lot of this bubble type stuff, because I believe that a lot of these SaaS names are right there. I mean, it's not as ridiculous as the EV market because the potential profitability is there for those companies. But you know, I do think the millennials, I was joking with somebody the other day that, you know, if it plays out the way that I think it will, which is that bubble of stuff pops, you know, 20 years from now, we could see the millennials as a bunch of gristled value investors. You know, right? I mean, you could. Like,
so Robin Hood's going to be stuffed with value names.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're going to have their Kraft Heinz and other. Well, and I'm not saying quickly. I'm just saying that everybody wants to bracket a generation. And every time, everybody thinks the youngest generation, oh, this is the one that went off the rails. You know what I mean?
That's right. You're absolutely, Zach, you're so right there. Every generation thinks the previous one is just insane.
Oh, yeah.
Or the next one is just insane. I completely agree. And, you know, think back, you know, I'm a Gen X, and I came, you know, cut my eye teeth during the dot-com bubble. And the old guys, I remember them saying that, like, you guys are insane. And we were, like, it wasn't me. I ended up doing something different in terms of, like, I didn't embrace the bubble mentality. I'm just too much of a contrarian at heart. You know, when I have a position and I'll suffer with a position forever, Zach. And then, you know, all of a sudden a few people start agreeing with me and I get nervous that it's over. It's crowded.
Yeah. To go off on that student one too, the other thing I wanted to address before we move on, I don't mean to interrupt you, but.
Oh, no worries.
We were talking about the student thing too. And I think part of this government spending, and I believe it's baked into the cake, that part of that is going to be forgiveness of student loans. And so I was having this discussion with a client the other day, and he goes, well, if you're right, Zach, and he goes, it makes sense to me if we think they're going to forgive student loans, is there a way to play that? And my answer to him was, I think there is. I think it's ITB. I think it's the home builders.
Oh, like, yeah.
Meaning you stop those student loan payments, man, and credit scores jump, disposable income jumps, and now all of a sudden, and people don't realize, when I first got out of college, now my college was way cheaper than what kids are paying today, but between my wife and I, we were paying $1,350 a month. My mortgage at the time was $1,580, right?
Right.
You start dropping those payments and you watch how quick that money floods into the housing, you know, the housing sector.
I was actually shocked that Trump didn't embrace creating a real estate bubble. You know, he was a real estate man himself.
Well, he wanted negative rates, Kev.
Yeah, I guess you're right. But, you know, if he had been smart, you know, embrace this what the Democrats have done. Can you imagine? Can you imagine if he'd gone out ahead and said, we're going to cut this and we're going to, you know, figure out ways to make it so you can all buy a home? And
I think he could. I honestly think he could have sold paying off student loans to his base, too. You know, and I think all you have to do is say, and I've got some clients who are very conservative that hate the idea of that. And I just look at them and I go, guys, look at the deficit you're going to run this year and how, you know, so much of the stimulus. And again, if they keep pumping it, I agree with you, you know, it's going to keep having that impact. But how much of the spending that they've done really has any multipliers to it up to this point? Really nothing. And if you pay off student loans, I mean, you know, paying off all the student loans in the country would equal what, 1/10 of this year's deficit, or 1/8 of this year's deficit, and how much of that spending, like I said, doesn't have the multipliers that paying off student loans does?
Yeah. No. Listen, it ends up being, though, a societal choice, and this is one of the things that if you go read more about MMT, you'll realize that a lot of the programs that are quote unquote MMT have been embraced by the left. And when you go speak to the people who came up with these theories, they'll say, no, you know, the government doesn't need to spend. The government could tax less as well. And, you know, we keep talking about the government, you know, these infrastructure programs. Another solution would be for the government to tax less. Now, the problem about that is that if you just end up taxing the people who already pay the majority of the taxes, which are the rich people, then it doesn't end up helping anything because they just go out and buy another, you know, car or whatever, or not even buying a car. They just buy more stocks often. And so what you really need to do is actually, you know, tax at the lower end less. So imagine if you made it so, like, I don't know what in Canada that your first 10,000 is tax free. I'm like, I'm assuming it's something similar in the US, but I don't know. But let's just imagine you made it so the first 40 was tax free.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And to your point, those people are going to spend that. That's going to make a lot bigger difference than the people that, you know, that are making 400 grand.
Yeah,
and even more so the ones making 4 million, and that's going to basically have zero multiplier effect, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, I would prefer they do it through tax policy.
Yeah, so, but that is a very still, listen, that's a very MMT policy, you know, and like I always joke and say, if I was the benevolent dictator of Europe, I would immediately cut, I would immediately raise rates. I would raise them because they are negative, and I think that is actually counterproductive. So I'd raise rates from minus 100 basis points. I'd raise them maybe to 25 or 50 with the hopes to eventually get them to 2. And I would cut taxes. I would cut taxes and keep spending until the economy balanced.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could do that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Where do we go in, you know, we're not the first people to be talking about this, but you still get back to this and you ponder, how long can this go on? I mean, what is money? You know what I mean?
So that is true. And that is one of the things that people start to realize, that it's not exactly what we think it is.
Right.
And more important is, what is debt? And debt is different for, you know, a government that issues currency, and it is for you or me, or even a, you know, government, like a city or a state. That those debt is all the same. Those entities can go bankrupt, but for government, they can't go bankrupt. And not only that, they're the ones that are actually deciding how much is out in the, you know, like in the Monopoly game. And if you made the Monopoly game, like imagine you made the Monopoly game, instead of going around, you know, getting 200 when you pass, you made it so you only got 25. Well, then there'd be a lot less, and it'd be more difficult. At the same time, if you made it so you made, you know, 2,000 every time you went around the Monopoly, then think about like all what people would be overpaying for stuff because everyone would be flush with cash. So it ends up being very, very kind of strange and difficult. And, you know, here's another thing. I don't know if I've told you about this one, if we've chatted about this, but Japan is often, you know, touted as this disaster and it's going to end so badly. And the people that were worried about debt, they say, look, they have 250% of their GDP outstanding as debt. Okay. And then, but the thing is, the Bank of Japan owns half of it. And so I always ask people, I go, what do you think happens if in the middle of the night, the Bank of Japan just rips up the stuff that it, you know, it owns. And if you think about it, it's like one arm owning what another arm has sold. And they're both the same entity. They're both the government. And so if you flip, so if you cut those up, I would, you know, so if you basically flatten that, I would argue that absolutely nothing would happen in the real economy. Zero.
I think their stock market would rip.
I think it would rip too, but let's just imagine you're not even worried about markets. You're just thinking about the real economy, because markets really, you know, are just a function to try to make the most efficient real economy. But right. On the whole, like the society's goal isn't to have stock market go well. The society's goal is to employ and, you know, enable and as many people to do well and to prosper as they can. And the argument has been made that the stock market makes that more efficient, but realistically, that's stock market is almost an offshoot of what we're really trying to accomplish. So if we think about the real economy, I would say nothing would change. Absolutely zero would change. And then you think, well, you know, we just said that the Bank of Japan, or sorry, the government of Japan owes 250% of GDP. And then you think, well, no, I guess they don't. I guess they own 125. Mm. And then you think, well, if they spent it before, they can spend it again. And you go, that's actually really scary, because that means the government can keep spending. And at which point you go, yeah, the government can keep spending. And this goes back to the MMT. There's never an actual financial constraint on governments like that. There's always just a real resource constraint, meaning that as the government spends too much, we get situations like lumber where things start exploding in price. And we get the government competing with you as, you know, in terms of trying to, you know, live your life and create something. And that's when you create inflation, when the government spends too much. And that is the real resource constraint. Like, I'll give you one line. I don't know if I've ever told you this one, but if you think back to World War II, when, you know, we just passed Pearl Harbor Day, and when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, America didn't go and say, we got to go build all these ships. We got to go all do all these things. We better check if the bond market will lend us this money. They didn't. They just went and spent it. They did what needed to be done. And this is part of the reason that COVID is also ushered in a similar mentality. It is a warlike footing that the governments have adopted. Mm-hmm. But anyways, back to World War II, the government goes and spends all this money. And then people will say, no, but there's war bonds. And yes, there were war bonds, but the war bonds actually came after. And the reason the war bonds came was because if you think about, let's just say, a fellow that's working in Toledo, Idaho, and he's making, let's just say, bullets for the army. And all of a sudden, he's making money, and he's feeling flush. And even though things are bad and scary, he's got these things. He decides he's going to go. He wants to go out and buy a new car. Well, that new car is actually going to take steel, hours worked, all sorts of things away, like in terms of real resources, away from the war effort. So the actual war bonds were not to finance the war. The war bonds were designed to change the consumer's behavior so they were no longer competing for real resources when the government needed to actually spend those real resources on building tanks, you know, boats, whatever.
They spend the money into existence, right?
Right.
Yeah. Which is just
and people have a lot of problems with that, and they just somehow think it's going to end about Zach. Is that when a government runs a debit, okay, the money doesn't just disappear; that money becomes a credit to somebody else.
Right.
So for every, you know, it just by like the nature of our accounting system. So our debits on the government side are actually the private sector's credits. And so we go back to why did America do so well over the past decade? It's like a lot of it is because you're increasing the deficits and debts. That became private sector credits. And at which point you can say, well, the government is never efficient and blah, blah, blah. I hear it. I understand all those arguments. And the more the government spends that's not efficient and the more the government does that's like not proper, you end up running up against the real resource constraint earlier. So, you know, one of my big problems is I really don't like Paul Krugman. And you might, for those listening, might go, well, he sounds like he's just up your alley. And I go, no, I cannot stand him. And one of the reasons is because he believes in the broken window fallacy. He really believes that you can go dig a ditch and then, you know, pay someone else to go and fill that ditch in and society is better off. And I argue, no, you basically have just wasted all that money and that money is going to be going, out the window, and we're basically, you know, going to find ourselves hitting the real resource constraint all the earlier because you're wasting real resources.
Well, and it also, one of the issues that I've always had with him is if you followed his agenda, I think eventually, maybe not right out of the gate, but eventually you would crush R&D, right? Well, why would you risk capital to run a risk-based enterprise when you can go get this government work with guaranteed outcomes? You know what I mean? With guaranteed profitability. You know what I'm saying? Like, nah, I recognize that it's not like Apple would quit making smartphones because they want to go dig the holes that Krugman's talking about. But it's a misallocation of capital. It's a misallocation of human resources. It's putting all kinds of bad incentives out there, isn't it?
Right. Now, having said that, though, let's just stop and think about the great financial crisis. The great financial crisis hit. We had all these people that were unemployed. There was all sorts of pain and suffering out there. And what did our government do? Our government went and bought treasury bonds because they thought this was going to fix our problems. Like, so the government, so everyone already wants treasury bonds because they're all worried about stuff. And so somehow the government buying more treasury bonds is going to fix it. At the time, I didn't realize it, and ultimately, I've come around to the kind of the notion that this was a very MMT type sympathetic view. But at the time, I said, no. If anything, the government should be doing the opposite. The government should be issuing bonds at these low rates because the market was desperate for bonds. They should be issuing bonds at this low rate and putting the people to work. So if the government can borrow money at 30 years at 1%, which is what I think we hit in the, you know, in the depths of the great financial crisis, if the government could borrow money for 30 years at 1% and we can go put fiber to everyone's home, wouldn't we as a society be better off? Why are we having, you know, another thing about the MMT folks is they sit there and they'll say, you know, they don't believe that unemployment is something that we should, you know, put up with. They think if the government has, if there's unemployment, the government can basically put those people to work. And it kind of, in some ways, makes sense. Why do we have unemployment? Like, I get it. There's a certain amount of people moving back, you know, around in terms of they're changing jobs and there's friction or whatever. But why do we have structural unemployment?
Because we subsidize it. Right.
So I don't know if I buy that.
I'm not saying that in a cruel capitalist sort of way. I'm saying that if they enacted what you're talking about, you could even do you could justify paying them more because you're actually getting productivity out of it and it's improving things. Right. Yeah.
Like, you know, so I've come around to this idea of this job guarantee because I just think about it. I'm like, well, if we're gonna be paying them anyways. And I know that's like not everyone's this way. So like just be careful. Like, people have trouble with me because they go, on one hand, you sound like this crazy left wing, and then you say these crazy right things.
Can I cut you off right there? Because yeah. there's something that I want to say, because if people are thinking that when they're listening to you, I completely sympathize. I was there. Right? No. Look, and I'm not talking about you specifically, but these ideas. I was there. Not that long ago, I was one of those guys admittedly saying that, you know, QE was going to cause inflation. And what I would challenge you to do, and this is what I was saying earlier about, you know, there's never this one answer, right? If you'll sit back and think this through, right, just put yourself in a room somewhere and stare at the ceiling and walk through these things in a rational basis. And when you do, and you leave your preconceived notions on the side, I think that what Kevin's saying is going to – and Kevin, what you're saying, it's going to make a lot more sense to people, because what you'll learn is that, yes, you're right. Eventually this ends in currency degradation, inflation, defaults. It eventually gets there. But right. If what the fear is deflation, collapsing businesses, asset values declining, if that's the enemy you are fighting, printing money – and giving it to people to spend, it will fix that. It right. Absolutely will fix that.
Yeah. No, I think that this will end with a lot of problems, but when I still think about it, I go, it beats the alternative. I mean, the alternative is like, you know what I think is hilarious is when I listen to people and they tell me, you know, low rates and government, you know, spending all this money is terrible. And I go, okay, so what's your solution? Your solution is that we raise rates and the government balances its books? And I go, do they understand what would happen to the economy?
I've had this debate with clients where I'm telling them, guys, the whole fiscal restraint balance budget, that ship sailed decades ago. If you balanced the budget and got fiscally responsible, you would have a Great Depression on your hands right now.
Yeah, it would be worse than the Great Depression.
Yeah,
people do not understand how bad it would be if we tried to do that.
Same people would want to rip whoever was at the White House. They'd want to rip them up and string them from a tree, right? It's like everybody wants to be idealistic. You know, it reminds me of the old adage that when your neighbor loses a job, that's a recession. When you lose a job, it's a depression, right?
Yeah, like, that's a great line. Yeah.
You know, there are no atheists in foxholes. And right now with the market at all-time highs, nobody's in a foxhole, right? You start, and again, I'm not and you're not an advocate of irresponsible government spending. That's clearly a big factor in how we got here. But nonetheless, it is what it is, right?
Yeah, I'm not even sure that we did have irresponsible government spending, but it doesn't really matter. I'm more upset about the thing that we try to fix everything with this monetary stimulus, and I think that we've actually created we've worsened the equality issues. And I think that when I look at what really makes me mad is like going back to this idea about that the government was buying bonds, you know, to try to fix the problems with the economy instead of helping the people who really need it by giving them a job. And that's what really bothers me about all this is that here we are and the economy, you know, the stock market's ripping to new highs and there's lots of people that are really struggling. Yeah. And we as a society are kind of also struggling with how do we still have a free market but make this more fair. And I think that having continual monetary stimulus is actually not the solution, is actually part of the problem. And so I really, really, truly think that a lot of these things are needed. And you know, I believe, like, this is going to sound crazy, but I believe the minimum wage should go up. I think I really do. I think that we should, everyone should be able to have a job where they are able to feed their family, and you shouldn't have to have, you know, three jobs to make ends meet. And
Kev, what about the work that's been done on that? And I'm not dismissing your assertion at all, but what about the work that's been done on the fact that if you raise minimum wage, all you do is decrease the amount of jobs?
Yeah, so I don't buy that. And one of the problems is, again, it depends if you monetize it, meaning if the government makes sure that there's enough money out there. And not only that, when you go look at the stats, I don't have them with me, but a lot of times a lot of that work is coming from think tanks that are being paid to come up with that solution. And like, I thought it was hilarious that President Trump was claiming there's never been the low end worker has, like, you know, the person that's not, doesn't have a lot of means, has never made more money than under him. And the reality is, when you went and looked at the programs that had been put in place on a state level, it was almost always because minimum wage was going up throughout all those states. I can't remember them all, but it was something like out of your states, like 35 of them were having minimum wage increases in either 2019 or 2020.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and there we were, you know, we had the best unemployment around in the last little while. And President Trump was bragging about it. So I don't buy those things. I know that that's the popular narrative. I think when you go and you dig in, you'll realize that a lot of those are wrong. And I look at the last, you know, 40, 50 years, and I look at the amount of kind of profits that have been kept by capital and the amount of profits that have been kept by labor. And the amount that's being kept by labor has gone way, way down during this period. Like, it's collapsed. And, you know, that some of that is from what we talked about, you know, on those deflationary forces. Because for a while there, you know, if anyone asked for a raise, they say, a raise? We're thinking about getting rid of your job and sending it to China. Right. Well, you know, when that happens, you're not asking for a raise, right? Like, and so this has been something that we as a society have been putting up with. And I think it's frustrating, and I don't think it's making our society any better. And, you know, I think that people love to see things in black and white. And I always say, you know, life's never that simple. And the truth of most arguments always lays somewhere in the middle. And so do I think that in the 80s, when Margaret Thatcher had to break the back of unions, that unions might have had too much power? For sure. I think it was the 80s. Maybe it was the late 70s. And there was a period where they had too much, and there's no doubt, you know, my father tells me stories about government workers here in Canada, and they would get, you know, 10% every year just automatically, and it was these terrible things because the government had negotiated, or the government's union, the Union of Government Workers had negotiated such a cushy plan, and the government had just given in on it. So there's no doubt about it that that's not good either. But I, you know, I look at this and I just say we hit an extreme, and I look at 2019 and look at that extreme, and I just hope that that trend has changed.
Yeah, yeah. What now? Before we go, I know you're a busy guy and you got to get rolling. I've already kept you on here for longer than an hour. But before we go, you did allude to this, and it's a bit of a hot topic. It's one that I'm pretty fired up about. But it feels to me like, and it looks to me like, we have a bit of a generational buying opportunity in energy. And maybe that's too strong words. And listen, I'm not encouraging anybody to go out there. I have no idea what's suitable for your portfolio. This isn't investment advice. I just think with the world set up the way it is and all the things that you and I talked about, I just look at these energy prices and the stocks and the companies, and it just looks screaming cheap to me. What's your take on that?
From your lips to God's ears.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my two daughters and my wife hate me for owning energy. And I know I'm a terrible right-wing capitalist by not thinking about these things. But I look at energy, and I think even though we are moving towards electric vehicles, the reality is that's going to take a long, long time. I look at the energy we're going to still need for all sorts of plastics and things like that, and people are still going to travel, and, you know, last I checked, jets take, you know, fossil fuels to get into the air. And so, and if you think about the last 5 years, it's been straight down. It's been just a pain after pain after pain. The stocks have gone absolutely crushed. There's no energy company out there that's spending any sort of money on CapEx. I can't remember the stats. It was something like for every, you know, 7 barrels of oil we use, we find one new one or something. I can't remember. It's some obscene thing. And then to add insult to injury, we had the negative, you know, oil market there in the spring, and who would have thought we'd ever see that? That's just absolute bonkers. The long and short of it is that this industry is being starved of capital. So there's nobody has put any money into it, which means that there's no new supply coming on. And in fact, supply is going to continue shrinking. At the same time, I look at the demand. I think the demand is going to fall off as sharply as everyone believes. And then on the other side, I think that China is about to experience growth and energy usage, the likes that we're going to be shocked at. If you go look at as countries become wealthy, they hit this kind of, it's a hockey stick, kind of curve, meaning it goes up a little bit, and then like at the blade, and then all of a sudden it just takes off. And that's usually like when I can't remember what the number is, it's like $5,000 per capita of GDP. And so we look at Japan coming out of World War II, the same thing happened. You go look at Korea in the 70s and 80s, the same deal happened. I think China has just hit that spot where they're going to start to use energy, and we're going to be kind of surprised at how much oil they're going to import, and we're going to be surprised at how little oil there is that these companies have to sell. I am completely with you, Zach. Well, some of my biggest holdings are long-term kind of energy fossil fuel companies, and I think it's tough. And you know, it was a lot tougher a month ago. It seemed like they were never going to rally. I was arguing that it was going to be around tax loss selling, that it was going to bottom. I waited a little too much, because it ended up being that they came a month earlier. But I'm with you. If you can if you don't get booted out of your house because you're buying the dirty fossil fuels, then I definitely think it's something you should look at for your portfolio.
Well, I think when it comes time to cash checks, those detractors inside our own homes will be more than willing to. At least that's.
Do you get the same flack?
Yeah.
Oh, do you have the same problem?
No, my wife isn't. She's not as involved. But you know, I've got some clients that were concerned about it, and I'm just like, guys, it's an inflation hedge, right?
Well, the other thing I'll tell you.
I'm trying to sell tell it you however I can. And before I forget to tell you too, I was on the Tesla Charts Chartcast recently.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this, and one of the threats or one of the comebacks I've heard from a lot of the energy bears is, well, yeah, but what about all the divestitures and what about people selling them? And I go, look, as long as this bubble and all this stuff keeps going up, then you're probably right. That'll hurt it. And I go, if what we're thinking happens and oil keeps climbing, you know, you're a guy that worked at a hedge fund. How fast will the divestiture talk stop? Right.
Right. Well, not just that, though. The divestiture, like you meaning that the companies and the pensions and everybody selling these stocks,
right.
It just that listen, that just makes it more difficult for these companies to raise money to spend to actually go and find more oil.
Right.
So the longer that continues, it just means the supply is all the less.
Yeah, they're bit, and it's why we always say, look, if you want to go after something like oil, you've got to come after it from the demand side, right? Like,
right. And that's the point is that I don't think the demand is going to fall as much as people think it will. And that's my point as well to my wife and my daughters, as I say, you know, like last I checked, we're still flying, you know, and not only that, the thing that really makes me mad is, you know, as a Canadian, we get all sorts of flack for our pipelines to the States, and it just ends up being a complete disaster. And then, you know, what happens is we don't have any pipelines, and what do? They stick them on trains.
Right.
So I say, you know, like the last thing generally people don't die when a pipeline, when something happens, yet when these trains go, we actually had 50 people, or maybe it's not 50, but tens of people die in Quebec when one of these trains went off the rails.
It's a fuel air bomb on wheels. Right.
I mean, yeah. And it just kind of makes me frustrated, because if you really want to change the world, don't be like stopping pipelines. Why don't we fix the demand, right? It's a little bit like drug dealers. I always say, if you go and put all the drug dealers in jail, all you do is put up the price of drugs.
Yeah.
If you really want to solve the world's problems, you should convince people to not use them.
Yeah, I mean, the war on drugs created crack cocaine, right? Which was an infinitely worse epidemic than the cocaine epidemic, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's the way it works. Well, hey, pal, I know you've got real work to do. I appreciate you, as always, coming on with us. Great to catch up. Great to get your insights, and really appreciate having you on. If you're a listener out there, I would strongly suggest that you – Kevin is a great source of unbiased, in my opinion. I think you're really good at cutting through the BS and, you know, focusing on the facts. So they can find you at the Macro Tourist blog. At themacrotourist.substack.com.
That's correct.
Very, very, very reasonably priced subscription there. And yeah. I think you're getting a lot of bang for your buck. So I'd encourage people to do that. And they can follow you on Twitter at the Macro Tourist blog.
Well, no, actually, that's my private one. And now that you are a paying customer, Zach, you got to go and ask for it. That's my private one. But actually, my public one is at Kevin Muir. Okay. So my private one, I end up just saying a little bit more my kind of, you know, trading in and outs, because one of the things is the letter is a little longer term focus. But there are those that, you know, want to trade every blip with me. And sometimes I'll go and get on there and talk about it there.
Right on. Well, I need to. That's like the secret password, man.
I'm the secret password.
I'm in the club. I got to get it.
You're in the club.
All right.
So if anyone wants to see a version of it, just send me an email. Shoot me an email, kevin@themacrotourist.com, and I'll send you some recent copies.
All right, buddy. I appreciate it again. And follow him.
A pleasure.
Go ahead.
Sorry, it was a pleasure being on with you. I really always love my Seattle friends. And you guys are the most like Canadians. I always enjoy it. You guys up there in the Northwest are wonderful people, and I love being on with you today, Zach.
Thanks. We just don't have any Hortons around here, man.
Tim Hortons.
Yeah, we don't have any Tim Hortons. Some TH. I always enjoy hitting
double
that
double.
Up. Yeah, there you go, buddy.
Take off, eh?
Yeah, there you go. It's as Canadian as hockey, right? Anyway, all right, Kev, thanks for being with us. And you guys, thanks for joining us today. As always, subscribe to the podcast. We will be back next week. Got another great interview lined up. Not going to tell you who it is. You'll have to tune in to find out. But anyway, thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Know Your Risk podcast on Know Your Risk Radio.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember, investing involves involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.